Morning, everyone. Can everybody hear me? Hi, my name is Nigel Kane, and with me is Alistair Doran.
Hello.
We're going to be talking about real-world solutions by CSC and Royal Mail. Well, Alistair's going to be doing most of the talking. I look after our technology adoption program, and Alistair's company has been working with us as part of this program and deploying System Centre 2012 into one of his customers, Royal Mail Group. And in this session, we're going to look at some of the lessons learned from that deployment and that experience, and also kind of the key success that Alistair's come across. Alistair.
Hello, everybody. The way we're going to proceed here is I'm going to give you a quick overview of both companies that have been involved in this, as both the CSC and Royal Mail. We'll give you an overview of what the program's about, the solution itself, and then we'll go into, towards the end, we'll go into the lessons learned. So first thing, a bit about CSC. We're one of the biggest global outsourcing companies in the world. We have around 90 to 97,000 people employed worldwide. We run a large amount of accounts. Probably the biggest one we run is the NHS. We're involved in that, along with several others. And then, of course, we run Royal Mail. We do all their outsourcing IT services in Royal Mail.
So, Alistair, for those folks that are not British, what's the NHS?
Well, the NHS is basically the national health. Not like America, over in the UK. Over in the UK, everybody's entitled to free healthcare, to look at basically any type of healthcare. So it's one of the biggest employers of the world, actually. I think their employee level is something like 250,000 or more. But so that's, you know, we manage several of the trusts that are within inside the NHS. Royal Mail. It is basically the, I'm jumping ahead of myself here. So we also have a very strong alliance with Microsoft. We are one of their global systems integrators. We're also an ISV, and we also do managed service providers. We've got membership in that area. And we work very, very closely. We've got our own joint website environments, talking about all the programs that we deliver together, and we're constantly trying to improve our overall service and how we deliver services together. So Royal Mail itself, Royal Mail is a bit like US Mail. It's the national mail provider in the UK. They deliver and have the responsibility by law to deliver email to every house in the UK. They deliver to, 29 million addresses across the UK. They're going through a lot of changes at the moment because the government is privatizing some parts of it and they're splitting them apart. So Royal Mail was originally set up as three organizations in one. One was Royal Mail itself, which does all the logistics to getting mail from A to B. Then they have the post offices, which is the retail-facing part, where people can walk in and buy stamps, get various services like passport services and things like that. And then the other one they have is the Parcel Force, which is their commercial division, which is a bit like DHL, FedEx, those sort of part. So the part that I work for mainly at the moment is the Royal Mail Group, which is Parcel Force and Royal Mail Logistics, looking after and getting all the emails all over the place. They've got, you know, as you can see some of the figures there, they've got a large number of vehicles to look after. They collect all the posts from the post boxes. So in the UK, we have post boxes dotted all around the country in some of the most remote places. And they got the responsibility of collecting posts from those post boxes every day. And not only that, but they're also trying to modernize because mail itself, the letters that you used to send and everything, that's rapidly dropping. So they're modernizing and bringing in other services to compensate for the loss of that that sort of service that they used to do themselves. And which led us to us working with Royal Mail. And they wanted to get themselves ready for this new journey that they're going on and transform the way they work and how they work to become more efficient, and for also for us to be improving our services into Royal Mail as well. So we came up with a program called the UEX program, where we're looking to transform the workplace for the end user. Now, people ask, what's the UEX program? Well, basically what it means is user experience program. And originally it was called UEX2 because we've done another program which was the first step towards this. We're refreshing all their desktops. We're improving the user's experience about how they can go about doing stuff. We're introducing self-service and automation. We're looking at all the processes, all the IT processes that we go through with them, optimizing those, making them far more agile. And we're introducing what we call end-user business continuity. Effectively, what we mean by that is the data that they have on their laptops, desktops, or everything, is in a constant state of being backed up to a central source so that if they ever lose that device, we don't lose data. And we're also building effectively a foundation for the way they want to operate in the near the future going forward. That's that part. From a CSC perspective, we wanted to use this opportunity to optimize our processes around how we deliver services to Royal Mail Group. Being a very large organization, we are very process driven. And sometimes we lose sight of being able to be more agile and effective in how we deliver those processes. We get locked in, well, it's done this way. And we actually, one of the biggest processes that you should go through each year is, or each, all on a continuous basis, is constantly reviewing the processes. We wanted to reduce our technical desk side presence. Up to this point, we were spending anything up to 4 hours delivering a desktop at the side. I gave, as part of this program, a target of getting that down to below 15 minutes. And also changing the level of desk side technical attendance there. I wanted to go from a systems engineer down to a technical courier, which we'll talk about going forward. Automated server deployment, bane of my life. No matter what SI I work for, I wanted consistent server bills, whether they're virtualized or physical. I want them to be delivered efficiently, quickly, on demand. And that was one of our other targets there. Improve our overall service catalog, so be able to give Royal Mail a better scope of services that we can provide them. And the last part was to also increase our ability to do rapid deployments into organizations like Royal Mail.
So, Alistair, one of the things you brought up was these are your objectives. So do you want to explain a little bit about how your relationship with Royal Mail?
So effectively our relationship, we are the primary outsourcing service provider to Royal Mail. We look after all their IT, and in some cases we actually own a high proportion of their IT estate. You know, we buy that in, or we bought it in ourselves, and then we provide it on a sort of a lease basis. We provide, we work with them on a daily basis with the IT departments and the business themselves on looking at what their business problems are and how they can go about solving them using IT.
So this helps you be more reactive and more supportive.
Exactly, exactly that. So going on, so how do we go about approaching this program? One of the things that we learned was, well, first, Royal Mail came to us and said, look, we've got 2 years left of this contract. We want to do something to get ready for the next contract when we go out to tender. Because they're still partly owned by the government, they have to go out to a public tender for the contract renewal. So they wanted to be prepared for that. They didn't want to have to put additional funding into that tender for whoever won that contract, which will be us, to go and spend and modernize their infrastructure when they took over, which is typically what has happened in the outsourcing world. Is an outsourcer will come in, they'll work through the program for the year, for the length of the contract. There'll be some updates and tech refreshes during the life of the contract, but there wouldn't be any major change of the way we deliver business. And this is where CSC are starting to lead in the outsourcing world. Is we're not doing that anymore. We're now looking to try and evolve with the company as they evolve and be able to deliver our services more effectively and give better services overall. So that's basically where we come from, you know, from that perspective.
So in terms of these key drivers and approaches, are these standard project approaches or are these things that are iterated through the private cloud?
So yes, there is some standard approaches in it. We don't go out of our way to break all the processes that we've got, but what we decided to do in this one was upfront, was effectively treat it like an agile type program, using some concepts, parts of the agile world of the way they do software developers do, where we were very collaborative. We constantly work, and still are constantly working, in delivering this program with the customer on an open basis, very much an open basis, where they're listening to what their requirements are. We go through discussion workshops. We agree the principles of how we go about delivering this program. We agree what we're delivering the program. And we constantly review that as we go through the program because, as you know, with agile development, once you've done your first sprint or your second sprint or third sprint, you relook at your deliveries and say, well, actually, are the next ones we're doing most important for us to do next? Or as a result of what we've learned, we've just delivered, well, actually, we might change the order of that and bring something forward, push something back, or even put something on the shelf for a temporary period. And we have done that. You know, there's been a number of places where we have gone through and we've reviewed it, and what we thought was a high priority at the time, both by the customer and ourselves, wasn't once we got 3-4 months into the program.
So is this a new approach for CSC?
It is. It's very much a new approach. Unfortunately, and fortunately, depends what way you look at it, I've got all the eyes of CSC senior people looking at this program and watching how it's been delivered, because it's going to be more widely adopted across the organization when it's proven to be successful.
So do you think this is a model that our customers and other partners should use for building private cloud?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's really important when you start bringing private cloud, community cloud, and even multi-tenant cloud, public cloud, because you have to be flexible. You have to listen to what the customer is. And I appreciate we have to standardize on some of the services that we do, but the trick is to standardize on the services but have modules that you can bolt down onto those services that are also standardized that make the that deliver what the customer needs, because every customer is different. I've never worked with any one customer that delivers in the same way. And even in the world of cloud, where things are getting standardized a hell of a lot more, which is a good thing, that you still have to have that level of customization, but customization under control. I tend to use the Dell model, where you go on to pick a customize, and you can customize your PC. The reality is, you can customize it within the parameters of what Dell have set out. You still feel you're getting a customized service, and you're getting what you need, but you're not going beyond the boundaries of what you're capable of delivering.
So let's kind of look at the architecture that you were working on.
Right, so a bit of background on the architecture before we go into the detail. As I said, it's a managed service solution. There's actually 160,000 people employed by Royal Mail, but only 27,000 of those people, which are sort of like the back office people from a Royal Mail's perspective, have actually got AD accounts, and this is the people that we're concentrating on the most here. We've got 1,400 sites, and there's sort of like the demographics of those sites. So you can see that, you know, there's only 1 to 4 people on the bulk of the sites, but we still have to look after them. We still got to get desktops out to them. We still got to get all our private cloud services, our services out to them. That's the thing. But the place that actually where the biggest piece of work is actually on those 50 plus ones, which I'll go into in more details. The network topology is a pretty simple network topology. BT deliver the networks for us, British Telecom. And we also have, offshore some of our frontline support and second level support to India. So we've got to think about making sure that they've got all the level of access that they need so that they can actually deliver the service that we are contracted into. So there's quite a wide variety of services. Not only that, but RMG were one of the first enterprise class customers to go on to BPOS, which is now obviously 365 dedicated. So we've got to look at that as well. And we had to take that into account when we were doing this program.
So one point on that, you've got the folks in India doing support. Can they remote into the clouds and the infrastructure that RMG are using?
Yes. All our Indian offshore employees had to go through effectively English or UK-based security checks, along with the Indian security checks, and they're all allowed to go into the organization and manage it as if they're on the premises. And that in itself was quite a hard thing, and we'll talk about this and more in the lessons learned part, but there was quite a big mindset change here. And the education program in getting our people in within CSC to think differently on how we are going to deliver services to the customer going forward was, you know, that in itself was quite just as big as actually delivering the solution itself. From the solution itself, from the virtualization side of things, we decided single virtualization platform with multiple pieces of hardware of varying types, with three core environments on top of that. And this is where we've also broken the mold a bit here too, because in the past we've always said development will have their own virtualized platform, pre-production will have their own platform, and then production will have their own platform. And I'm thinking, I'm going through this with my leads in each of the areas that we've involved in this, why are we doing this? Because virtualization's moved on really, you know, leaps and bounds here. So why are we doing this? Why aren't we not just sharing one single virtualization platform? Because what that means is when you get down to sort of like end of year runs or Christmas is a really big thing for Royal Mail, we can draw those resources off the other two environments, non-critical environments, and put them into the production environment just literally by a click of a button and running a few scripts and then give it back when we're finished. And nobody's affected. But it means that they have resources that are very flexible and agile. So we decided to just use a single virtualization platform.
Just bringing on, building on that point, so initially what you've done is you've taken all the servers that used to be in dev, test, and pre-prod, and just put them all in one block.
All running on one block of virtualization. It's actually two clusters. We've got two VMware, or Hyper-V clusters. We do have also a VMware cluster environment as well, which is running some of the major critical applications in some of our data centers. But there's discussions going on at the moment. Do we want to continue running two virtualization platforms? Probably for the next few years, purely because of the cost that it will take to shift them. But what we're also discussing is, well, how can we bring this all into manage from one place, which we probably will do.
The thing I really like about that approach is we've seen, as you mentioned, a lot of customers where they've still got islands of hardware which is dedicated to a particular type of environment. What you've done is said, okay, we'll forget those boundaries, they're artificial. We'll create one set of hardware, and then we'll basically create clouds which represent these different environments. So it's very different from what I've seen in other customers where they actually have dedicated hardware for particular environments. They've just said, okay, forget that, let's just have these clouds that represent those environments.
Yeah, that's very true. And the most important part there is your data center network topology, and I won't hide from it. We went through some hell in that area for reasons I will go into in the near future. So some of the key technologies that we've used, obvious one is System Center 2012. I will talk a bit more about that. SQL, we have also used, we're rolling out Windows 7 EN for the clients, Office 2010 Pro. We've got Office 365, which has caused us some challenges because during this migrate or during this upgrade or refresh or whatever you want to call it, we've decided, right, we're dumping this 2003 domain over here and we're shifting it over to a greenfield 2008 R2 domain. So we had to go through a migration process of taking all the Office 365 accounts from one domain over to another domain as the users migrate their desktops over. So we had to build a lot of scripting in. We've got a lot of talks with Microsoft. And to be fair, both of us are learning on that, especially Microsoft Services. We're both learning on this. We're one of five companies that are doing this at the moment around the world. So in a sense, dare I say it, and I know our company, my bosses wouldn't like me to hear, but we are being a bit of a guinea pig here in this situation. So when you but it's turned out very positive.
When you mentioned the System Center 2012 suite, I believe, Alistair, when we were talking, you deployed early. What version of VMM did you go into production with?
We went into production with VMM 2012. I think we were one of the first, actually, to go into production
in
2012.
You're in production with the beta?
Yeah. We went in with beta 2, I think it was. Yeah, it was beta 2. We were going to go with beta 1, but Microsoft stopped us. Because there was a number of bugs there that would have affected us. And I listened to that. I didn't fight it because they are the best guys. They know what's going to cause us problems before we... So we went in with beta 2. Some of the things that we found hard, and again, we'll go through them, the thing was that in the early days of the TAP program, some of the products weren't keeping in sync with each other. And therefore weren't ready for us, so we had to make some decisions to put some of the products on the back burner. We'll go into that in more detail in a short while.
Of course you meant components, Alistair.
Components, yes. So these are all the ones highlighted in yellow are basically all the ones that are related to the data center environment that we set up, the VMM environment. The other parts are directly related to the end user environment that we set up. We are also rolling out Direct Access, which is big, big change for the Royal Mail Group because they're used to this good old reliable VPN service, you know, click on a button, connect in, and we're going through an education program with Royal Mail Security Group to help them make the decisions on around that area. It's been slow to take off that particular part. We're still delivering that part. We've used NetApp storage also as our back-end storage environment. And again, we've lots of lessons learned, which we'll go into more detail on that as we go through. And the other one that actually I'm not mentioning here is 1E Nomad. Because we have such a dispersed site environment, we couldn't justify putting a deployment point in every site. It just wasn't on. So we needed to find some other way to deliver desktops remotely because we're doing self-service desktop delivery at those sites. And what we found the best way to do this is with 1E Nomad. And they complement it. And they've worked very closely with us on the 2012 TAP to help us get over some of the fixes that they were waiting as we went through the build cycles. So this is the infrastructure environment. Very busy diagram, appreciate that. There's a lot there, but as you can see, there's a lot of consideration to go into. But if you look on the, it would be the left-hand side to you, that's that column on the left-hand side is the most important column because that's where all our virtualized platform is. The rest of it, the BOAs I want to go into, and BOA, sorry, I keep using acronyms here, branch office, appliances, now it technically actually you probably should call them branch office hosts because they're actually the Hyper-V servers hosting VMs for some of the services at each of the sites. And again, I'll go into more detail on that.
I think one of the things you mentioned also when we were talking about this slide is the fact that you've got differing network speeds between all these different environments.
Yeah. So our network speeds go from nice big fat pipes around 15, 20 meg more on some of the main sites down to ADSL connections at some of the smaller sites. Most of them, with the exception of about 100 or so, are around 2 meg ADSL. The ones that cause us real heartache, like out in the Outer Hebrides, the Shetland Islands, Hong Kong, because there's some of the remote sites there, they've got quite low bandwidth and it hurts us there. And the way we've overcome that, because of the flexibility of SCCM, is we're actually delivering desktop refreshes on that on a stick. So I'm delivering it that way. And then SCCM picks it up and says, all right, so you've now started your upgrade, and then it pushes down any updates that need to come along. So that's what the core part of the infrastructure and the part that I'm involved. Now, what you're not seeing here is probably about double that again on application servers that are out there for running all the Royal Mail applications. We decided as part of this program not to involve the applications at this point in time. They're still sitting in the 2003 domain, and that domain is now being treated as a resource domain until such point in time that, one, we've got this under control and we're rolling it out, and then we'll bring each of those products as they're due for a tech refresh or an update over into the new domain and put them onto this platform. So this platform will grow and grow and grow going forward.
So I know, Alistair, you've got a demo of just kind of we want to show people this was real. And so do you want to...
Why don't we first go into just a little bit about VMM and then we'll talk about the demo.
Let's do that.
Yeah. So the data center architecture, VMM 2012, virtualized platform, we talked about most of this. We have cloud structure, we've used the bare metal build capabilities. We've used SIMs for the storage and provisioning thing. That is one of my real happy moments, where I no longer have to rely on the storage team to provide me some storage to my servers. I can actually provision it myself, which means that I don't have to get on the phone about 60 times in one day saying, where's my storage? When are you going to give it to me? I can go in there and script it and deliver it, and it's been really, really good. NetApp have played a big part in this and getting that to work. And we've gone through quite a bit of pain. We got into a lot of discussion around how the storage configuration should be, and I'll show you in the next slide or the slide afterwards on this. We had some debate because they had some, let's put it this way, a little conflict on white papers that they released within about 10 weeks of each other on what way storage should be configured on a VMM cloud. And then we also had some debates around VMM libraries specifically for the branch office hosts as well, which I'll go into.
So one of the things we talked about was around the security of this. You've created these clouds on top of this genericized hardware.
Yeah.
How did you go about thinking, or what did you think about in terms of scoping out security and roles and responsibilities?
So what we actually did try to do was carry over what security models we already got in place. We tried to air gap the environments as much as possible from a virtual perspective. You don't use the same account to go into your pre-production environment. When I'm talking about accounts, I'm talking about administrators. We don't use the same accounts to go into each environment. We use separate accounts, so there's no chance of cross-contamination. So there's some a bit of old school still there. Like, I know there's some organizations out there saying, well, so how do you lift when you've done pre-production and you've done your testing? How do you lift that across into the new environment? Well, the reality is whatever we put into our pre-production environment, we script into our pre-production environment so we can just run those scripts and rerun it in the production environment because we're happy with it. We've got quite a tight, what I call devolved management structure of security on who can do what. There's specific groups that can only deploy VMMs. There's Hyper-V guests There's groups that can only deploy applications. There's dedicated groups for SQL. There's dedicated groups for monitoring and management. But that's just because we're such a large organization. It's more justifiable for us to have different skill sets in to monitoring different parts, and they'll be monitoring multiple accounts at the same time.
So just kind of close on that, would you say one of the key lessons learned is to have, for these different environments, to have different accounts?
Yes, for the moment, I would say. Going forward, I would start a debate on that going forward, because I think what is important when going forward is let the person have the same account, but depending on the environment they go into, the level of access and what they can do going forward is the right thing. Because a lot of people, especially the SI people, large companies like us, we tend to forget that user experience doesn't stop at with the customer. User experience needs to go right through to the very person at the very back that's running the data center. Because if they have good user experience, your productivity, your flexibility of being able to do jobs, get things done, is going to increase. It's really important. This is one of the things I tried to hone to everybody, and why we had to go through quite a large education process, is that it's not just about the end user experience, it's also about the user experience for the people that are delivering those services. So you can see, this is how the VMM environment is set up and all the different parts of it. From the self-service side of things, of being able to do via RAISE and create virtual guests, we are going through probably a 2 to 3 phase process. At the moment, it's only CSC people that can fire up those VMs on request by the customer. Going forward, that will probably get closer and closer to the customer. Our plan and our objectives is to get to there, that the end user will be able to go on and say, I want to request a VM because I'm starting a new project and I need this application, or I need this data services or whatever fired up, and they'll be able to request that. They'll be asked a certain set of questions that they fill in, and depending on that, the service will be delivered to them. But we're in the early days there. If we try to make a big jump, and I would highly recommend that people think very carefully about this, of jumping from complete outsourcing, where all the things are done by the outsourcer, to giving it all to the customer to do, it's a big mindset change, and a lot of things can go wrong, and it can leave people with very sour taste in their mouth when it goes wrong, and it puts them off what you're actually trying to deliver to them. So, take it in small steps, one step at a time, get people used to it, get them to the point where they're asking, well, can we not do that now ourselves? That's when they're ready for doing it. Don't give it to them straight away. So I briefly talked about the storage, and the reason why I put up this slide is you can see we've got one big CSV file in our cluster. We went through lots of discussions with NetApp on this, because their original, and rightly so, for the right reasons, was to split the storage up to every host within that cluster. But that gives you drawbacks around moving machines around and failing over and all that sort of thing. And then they released a white paper back in October about, no, actually the best approach for a Hyper-V platform is to put one big blob of storage in there and then a couple of small pieces each side for quorums and things like that. But there's issues with that as well, because when you're using snapshot capabilities, you get latency on the snapshots because of the way it shifts around between the different hosts. And they were recommending us to stay with the individual storage at that point in time because of this, because we are using snapshot capabilities, because we're replicating all this storage to another data center site. So in the event of being able to fail over and things like that, if one of our data centers gets blown up or whatever. We decided against it at that point in time because, one, we knew that they were coming out with updates on the snapshot technology that could correct this problem, and two, the benefits that we gained out of going this route far outweighed the problems that we would have to deal with in using the snapshot. And what we did was, for the areas that were critical, like SQL clusters and everything, we detached them from the backup of snapshots and used native snapshotting technologies for them in that particular, which actually gets me on to the next slide. Another thing that we learned about storage was, originally, we've got a 5-node cluster, that SQL cluster, that manages and provides services to all our system center and our self-service and portal, that is, that's sitting on the virtualization platform itself. We originally tried to present those disks through VMM to the SQL cluster, and that caused us endless amount of trouble. And it was only after about a couple of weeks that we discovered, well, actually the best way to do this is you present these disks directly to the thing. So when you're doing clusters like SQL clusters on a VMM platform or a Hyper-V platform, is keep your clusters presentation, your disk presentation to those clusters separately, because it doesn't work in the other way. Now, I haven't looked at it properly yet, but I believe 2012 might be different when it comes along. But at the moment, that's the best way to do it with the current release of Windows. Okay, it's all in a nice SCSI connection. We got a 10 gigabit iSCSI backbone on that, and the performance is phenomenal. And that's why we've not carved up our disks that much for the SQL cluster either. And we've kept it pretty simple. And it was one of the things that we actually did, because of all the things that we had to deliver in this program, was the mindset was keep it simple as much as possible. We can always add the complexity in afterwards. Just make an assessment. Do you need to take into account that complexity that you might want to add in later now, so that you're effectively putting the foundation down for it? So, before we go into and actually show you what the environment is, one of the other areas I want to touch on was the branch office architecture. We've basically got two branch office type architecture. We've got a large site and we've got a critical site. And the only real difference between the large site and the critical site is one gets two branch office appliances, and the critical ones get two branch office appliances. Now, they might necessarily be actually any bigger than the large site. The only reason for that is there's VIPs, or there's a VIP service running at that site that can't do without something failing. On each of those hosts, we have two VMs. We've actually taken, this is one of the big gains that we got, was there was anything up to 4 or 5, maybe even sometimes 6 servers out at each site that we had to manage locally, do tape backups on, do all that sort of stuff. And we brought it down to either one single box or two boxes that is replicated up into the data center. So the box can be effectively treated like a black box, and it hosts all the services. We put read-only DCs in there. That's one VM. Our AD guys insisted on us having a separate VM for AD. And I sort of had to agree with them, even though I didn't at the first. We went again. Being me, I always had a good debate with them to find out, to make sure we were making the right answers or doing the right thing. And then we've got the other server, which is basically the backbone of a site services. That's your deployment point from SCCM. You've got your printing services, which is a centralized printing services. You've got your DFS shares out there, so replicating back up into the data center. And there's a number of other things. And the other one that's not shown in this diagram is we've also virtualized the existing 2003 domain onto that as well. We're doing a P2V so that we can shut down that box and put it onto that machine until such point that all the users have been migrated off that AD, and then we can shut down that AD completely. The main thing that we learned that's worth noting that we learned on this one was recoverability of your VMs. We found that when we were doing our tests and our assessments, that calling the templates down from the central data center to some of these sites was taking too long. So what we did is we used DFS to help us there by replicating the BOA library templates down to the actual hosts down in the sites so that we could recover and rebuild or build new servers in some cases on the actual hosts themselves. And that's something worth noting when if you're doing a dispersed environment. So we'll have a very quick look at the environment just to show you that it's actually real, which I'm sure you believe me, but just in case.
Do you want to drag that across ours so we can see a nice pretty picture right now?
I will indeed. In fact, what I'll do is I'll I'll go to dual mode. If I can hit the right keys, or duplicate mode. So just bear with me one second. So this is our server environment. There's still a lot of work to be done here because we're constantly doing it. And last week we went through a critical update that was recommended by Microsoft to get us to RTM, get us ready for RTM. So some of the stuff we actually had to go through a process of uninstalling, and we've not reinstalled that yet because we want to make sure that the underlying services are all working properly before we go on. So bear with us on some of the things not being the way they should be. I suppose the first part of showing you here is the storage fabric here. It's quite simple. There's basically two sets of environments here. We've used the classification. We've kept it simple. We've got a SAS set for the high performance requirements, and then we've got the SATA set for this all like more the low end storage for thing. But having said that, the SATA is fast in itself. Like SATA these days to what SATA was 5 years, 3 years ago. There's a big comparison. Like SATA these days is like SCSI disks about 2-3 years ago. The speed of them is phenomenal because they've got big cache up front and everything. It's also worth noting that our storage at the moment, the way we've done it is we've actually put in a pay-per-use per gigabyte storage. So we have bought the frame of the storage and we have agreed an upfront baseline minimum usage of storage. And every gigabyte after that, RMG pay for it if they go above that. But if they stop using it, they don't have to pay for it. And we're finding it working very well. There's big savings for Royal Mail on that going forward.
Do you charge different rates per SATA or SAS?
Yes, we do. Yes. So the SAS is probably about double the SATA, which makes them think. One of the things that they're trying to do is make their end users more aware of what they're costing their organization. So when they log into, going forward, when they log into my site on their SharePoint environment, they'll actually get an overview of what they're using within the Royal Mail group. So they'll be told, you're currently using 30 gigabytes of data center storage, which is costing X. You're using this amount of mail storage, which is costing Y. They get their phone details of what it's costing, et cetera. So they know, and this is not to have a go at them or anything like that. It's actually just to get people aware of what they're costing. They become naturally, without forcing or bending their arm behind their back, they naturally become more aware and more conservative on how they use the resources. And we find that, it's all down to the psychology that you present these messages to your end users. If you present it in such a way that you're not fighting with them and forcing them to do it, they'll naturally look after what they're doing and how they're using those resources. You'll always get the exception, but you're going to get those exceptions whether you force them or not. And we find it's working very well.
So in terms of the servers and environment you've set up, do you want to show everyone what you've got there in terms of your cloud fabric?
Right, so the cloud fabric is still a bit messy at the moment, but these are all the hosts. So you can see there's a lot of hosts there, and that's because we're managing all the the BOA environments from the one central source as well. We have network environment. We've kept it reasonably simple. We got a number of VLANs for different reasons, pre-production, production, and then we have classifications within production itself. And then I would say, let me go here. This is all our VMs that we're running at the moment. I'm just looking for, what am I looking for? Yeah, this is it. So, okay. You will notice actually a few problems here once it's finished refreshing. Since we've done the updates, we've found that some of the daily performance and monthly performance counters are not reporting back, which we're currently investigating. And you'll also notice that we've got our power management switched off because we had a strange situation where we were having servers randomly shutting down, virtual servers randomly shutting down, which we did get to the bottom of, but we haven't switched this back on yet. It wasn't actually the power management that was causing the problem. It was actually a Hyper-V bug, which we missed on a hotfix that we should have deployed. And it was where one host was actually causing problems across the cluster to randomly shut down machines. And unfortunately, one of those machines one week was the SCCM deployment service. So we were told about it very quickly.
Oh, sorry, I noticed you've got 55 hosts there. What's the, is that the kind of first part of the project?
That's the first wave of hosts. There's going to be a total of branch office, there's going to be a total of 116 hosts there. In the data center, well, if everything goes to plan, that will probably double. We've got about 35, 40 hosts at the moment. Some of those hosts, if I collapse this and go to the 580s here, these guys here, and I just couldn't get my head around this when we first got these machines, but each one of these machines has got 40 cores in it, right? It's a four socket box, and each socket has got 10 physical cores. And we could have actually got 12 cores, but they weren't available at the time, so we just took that. It's only quarter full of memory at the moment. We're actually going through putting in more memory because we're not even sweating the CPUs at the moment. CPUs have never gone above 10% yet. We're not sweating them, so we're not worried. The thing that we're sweating at the moment is the memory when we do failovers and things like that. So what we're doing is we're putting more memory in. We're sitting around 128 gigabytes of memory per machine at the moment. We're going to double that first wave round. Second wave round, we'll probably double that again. Like, I think there's something like 24 banks in this, capable in the servers. It can go up to 1,024 gigabytes or something like that of memory of these boxes.
When you plan the infrastructure, presumably you are planning in advance, because
yeah.
A lot of times when we look at cloud and cloud provision, we put in provision in advance of demand. So I guess that's what you've done here too.
Yeah, to a degree, that's what we've done. We also, if you look at the second environment here, the second cluster, this cluster, you're only seeing, we've only taken a number of this. This is actually a 32-node or 32-blade environment. We've got the first four blades, although I noticed we've only got two blades in service at the moment. So something's been going on while I've been away here. We're planning, there's previous version of Hyper-V running on the other blades at the moment, on 2008, not R2. And our plan, as soon as we have finished and got everything stabilized in this environment, is to then bring those blades in under VMM 2012. At the moment, they're under VMM 2007. And we just have to do a planning session to bring those over in a phased thing, because they're running production applications. So they are.
You mentioned VMware.
Yeah.
Are you going to be bringing VMware into this management infrastructure?
If I have my way, yes. We will. I think there's been massive improvements in 2012 and being able to manage the two environments under the one hood. But again, with a large organization like ourselves, it's down to education, getting people to understand what we can do together. And to be fair, we as a company have been a very strong VMware organization up to now, and it's only in the last 2 years that we've really started taking Hyper-V quite seriously, a lot more serious. And I have to say, some of that is because of money. It speaks, it's cheaper to put a Hyper-V environment, and it's just as good. And with what's coming in 2012, that'll be even the story will be even stronger. So well, okay. So that's our Hyper-V environment. You can actually see it in working environment. Don't think there's anything much more, so I'll go back to the slide deck.
You want to drag that data across again when we see one side?
Yes, just because it's. One sec. Excuse me, one sec.
So, whilst it's getting set up, I mean,
there we go.
The key thing there, we're going to go through all of the different pieces, but you've got most of the System Center suite in production already.
Yeah, that's right. So, just to give you a quick overview of the other components, just to show you that we have been using the other components. The first one I'll touch on is SCOM. Believe you me, when you're setting up a Hyper-V clustered environment and treating it as a cloud, your next best friend is SCOM. You really believe it is massively important to have something like SCOM in there to monitor and tell you what's going on, because it's so easy to miss it when you go into VMM, especially if you've got a large environment with so many servers like us, to miss stuff. You need that tool there to be alerting you and telling you what's going on. Things. So, and we're using SCOM for the whole of the Wintel environment that we're deploying it. It helps us accelerate the call resolution. Because of the knowledge that's built into the tool set, you're already starting one step ahead. It helps us enhance our capacity management in a really big way, because we can start to see trends build up as the further we go into the program, we'll start to see trends build up of how usage, when are the peak times of usage, what pressure is put under. And the other thing is that we're using SCOM ACS to do detailed security monitoring. We've had a couple of instances in the old environment where we had someone do something that they shouldn't have done, and we couldn't trace it. So one of the first things that I did before we start rolling out any of the production servers was we put ACS in, and every single server has ACS on it, so that we are capturing the logs before they get deleted. Because if you get a denial of service, what people miss is if you get something like a denial of service attack or something like that, you have your logs on doing a round robin or a roundhouse, they get deleted really quickly. So you're losing the initial attacks, you're losing the initial sessions that kick off. So by putting ACS in, you're collecting that data as it happens. Standard SCOM deployment. Things we will also use that you'll see on that diagram is we're using SCOM gateways for some of our environments, because some of our environments are on non-CSC data centers. We've got our breakout into the internet is in the telehouses, what we call telehouses of BT. So we've got servers down there that we have to monitor and manage, and there's Hyper-V hosts down there that we have to service and monitor as well. So we put a gateway in there to manage those. Also, our environment is quite locked down. We don't use Layer 3 intelligent routing on switches. We use firewalls to do all our routing, which I have to say was a challenge in itself, and we'll talk about that in the lessons learned. you need to know your ports, let's put it that way. So that's our standard agent deployment. You'll see the red is showing the ACS collections. The blue is your standard agent deployment. There's nothing special about it. It's just it's important to get it right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So it is. Then we go on to Orchestrator. Now, Orchestrator, it'd be fair to say that we're very much in the early stages of Orchestrator and Service Manager. And the reason for that is Orchestrator and Service Manager weren't in sync with VMM and SCOM back in the early days of the TAP, and we couldn't sit around and wait. So we had to develop some of our own self-service environments, which I'll touch on in the future, near future on these slides. But we do realize the power of Orchestrator, and we're starting to doing, and we're taking a step-by-step, careful step-by-step approach on this, because we've realized the power of this tool. It's a massively powerful tool. We're already using this in a really big way previous to Microsoft buying it when it was Opalis on the VMM or VMware platform, along with other places as well. We also use it in some of our service center call management tools. So we know what the power of this is. So we're taking it very much a step-by-step. We're doing a full assessment of all our processes at the moment, using our business analysts to identify what are the ones that are going to be the processes that are going to gain the most out of it, and what are they going to be the quick wins and the big wins for us and everything. The first thing that we're probably going to do is, we've actually started doing, is a full automation of a branch office appliance. Now, we are doing bare metal bills at the moment, but it's still manual to a certain extent. We don't actually have to build the branch office appliance when it arrives on site, because the person plugs it in and then tells someone back at the data center and they kick off a bare metal bill for us. But what we do have to do is manage that whole thing of getting the server down to the site, commissioning, understanding, installing the services on top. And we know that because of the changes that Royal Mail are going to go through over the next 2 years, a lot of their sites are going to change profiles. So some sites are going to get bigger, some sites will shut down, new sites will come up. So we know that there's going to be lots of changes around the branch office appliance. So we wanted to use this one as the opportunity to really prove and test Orchestrator and Service Manager around this area.
In terms of the flow then, you built the fabric.
Yeah.
You're monitoring the fabric. And the next step is then to get into automation.
It's get into automation over and above the small amount of automation that we have around deployment, automated deployment of hosts and things like that. And also, we are going to use it in our second phase self-service environment, which I will touch on after service, or SCCM. We're going into that now. Okay. So, Service Manager, again, we're in the early stages of that. I've just realized, actually, there's a slide the wrong way around there.
But doesn't matter.
Service Manager, we're in the early stages of that. We're looking and exploring. This is going to be a big change for us because we use products like Remedy and others, which overlap in functionality here quite a lot. So again, we're having to go through the organization and go through the qualifying processes of what's best to use in what accounts and everything. But it's pretty sure that we're going to use it in some way going forward. The first phase we'll probably use it is for our frontline guys, so the guys that handle the calls that come in for requests for a service to be deployed or for even a laptop to be deployed or something like that, is they'll use Service Manager for that capability of doing that. Second phase will be to probably bring that self-service part and start exposing it to the customer, but we're all in the early stages in that area. So the last area that I'm probably going to cover before we go into the lessons learned side of things is a little bit about what we did with SCCM. One of the things that, as I explained at the early beginnings, was that we wanted to deploy, we have 27,000 desktops to deploy. We wanted to do that in the most economic way so that we could meet the challenges of the money that RMG provided us and also improve how they get those desktops. So we decided, why don't we set up a self-service portal for them to deliver their desktops? Now we're delivering both hardware refresh and then just OS refresh. So what we did was we went off and started building a self-service environment, which is running on IIS and it's using .NET 4 and it's connecting into SCCM going forward. So part of self-service portal is we've got application, we're doing all the application portfolio management. We're also rolling out, we're changing from a third-party BitLocker encryption to third-party disk encryption to BitLocker. We adopted MBAM to manage the BitLocker. We also use the engaged in doing the user data migration. We're doing device management, and then there's the reporting aspects of it as well. The next couple of slides are just examples of what the self-service portal looks like. This was totally developed around the end user experience. This whole program is sort of like being developed from the outside in, so from the user back into the data center, not what a typical way was. We'll develop all the products and then we'll try and get the users to fit the they'll develop the solution and try and get the users to fit the solution. We've developed from the user back inwards. So we had big involvement from RMG, selected users from each of the departments involved in working out this portal and how it should look and feel, and are they happy enough with it. And, you know, it's simple things like being able to register, confirm where you are. A lot of this information we already had. So we've drawn that from a number of databases and we've fed it into the logon page and they've just said, yes, that's us. Then they would verify if they want to upgrade on the site that they're assigned to or do they want to upgrade at a site that they're currently working at. Then they go into the process of actually selecting the time. They'd also go into a process of saying, because as soon as they've registered and we sent them out email communications, we download agents. Customized agents that are associated with SCCM, along with the SCCM agent, to make an assessment of their environment. And then that tells us all the applications they got. We then have already done a DNA of those applications for the whole environment. And we can tell them that, yes, you're ready to be migrated, or no, you're not ready to be migrated because we're still doing some application remediation on some of the applications that they can. And we've even given them the ability to opt out of that application down to quite complex workflows where the user, if they decide to opt out of an application because they want to get on Windows 7, but that application is considered critical for the service, the department they're working for, that if they've selected an application they want to opt out, it'll go to their line manager to say, is it okay for this person to opt out of this application? Because they want to get onto Windows 7, because it's considered one of the primary applications. So we've developed all those areas. We've done a lot around workflow management. We've also done things around network-attached printers. One of the things that SCCM is not very good at doing, and when you're going from one OS to another OS in the migration process, is picking up network-attached printers. So we developed some WMI scripts and everything. It's part of this query process that identifies what printers you've got attached to your PC. We store that in the database, and then when they get deployed onto the new desktop, then it goes up and queries the database and says, what printers am I supposed to have? And it tells them, and we recreate those print queues on the desktop. We also put a lot of effort into the reporting side of things. So the local and regional coordinators that are delivering these desktops know exactly what are going on. They know what progress is in place. They know where there's problems, even to the point that If we deploy a desktop during the night, because someone's elected to have their desktop upgraded during the night, we will know there's a problem before the user knows there's a problem. And we'll have a local technical consultant go out and start fixing that desktop before that person arrives in the morning. Okay. And that's just basically a schematic diagram of how we've integrated with SCCM, SQL, using self-service portal environment, even down to the point of where it even our self-service environment coordinates and runs the scripts to do the migration in the BPOS side of things or the Office 365. We still use BPOS in some cases, we probably shouldn't do, where we run the scripts to transfer them overnight or in the few minutes overnight. Some of the things that we learned around that area, just if anybody's in this situation, is that moving the accounts from exchange reattachment and OCS reattachment or a link reattachment is quite easy. The one thing that caught us out and it still is catching us out, and we're in quite considerable dialogues with Microsoft Online Services in this area, is the reackling of all their data on their SharePoint environment, because that takes quite a lot of processing power, so they only allow it to run at night. So you've got to plan how you do that when it comes to the customer. So we run two cycles. If you're going to be migrated in the morning and you've selected a slot to be migrated in the morning, we'll run the process for reackling data the night before. If you're going to run an upgrade in the afternoon, we'll run the reackling that night, so the customer is only ever 12 hours possibly without access to SharePoint data. And that's about it from the solution point of view. The lessons learned, we've gone through quite a few of them already, and I'm just conscious that we're running out of time. I think the main thing I would have to say to you is, from a delivery point of view, is education, getting your people on board to deliver this. That is really, really important. The business as usual, the people that deliver the solution, that run the solution after you've delivered it, it's a big change for them. They have to be taken on the journey too. Get them involved from day one. Get them to understand what you're trying to do. Otherwise, you'll meet a lot of resistance because they have processes and ways of doing things that they know work that keep the customer happy. And to change their mind and deliver in a slightly different way that will end up giving better service to your customer going forward, you have to convince them. It's for you to convince them. It's for you to inform them that doing it this way is actually going to give a much better service and set you up for the future. Project management, I think it goes without saying, is absolutely key. In our case, we use Microsoft Consultancy Services because we were going into applications that we didn't know 100%. So if you don't know your applications that well, or you're going on a journey that you've not gone on before in this area, really important, and I would highly recommend that you bring those guys in. Know your library structures and templates, service templates, how you're going to configure it. So it's important to plan up front, document everything so that everybody knows what's going on. It's really important, actually. One of my biggest roles in this was, like, as you probably have picked up, I'm not the hands-on guy that plays with every piece of the product. Or the, you know, each of the solution parts in the solution. My role was to make sure that I've got a stream that's running, delivering SCCM. I've got a bunch of guys that are delivering VMM. I've got a bunch of guys that are delivering SCOM. I've got orchestrator guys over there. Is to make sure that all those guys are connected because they've got very large dependencies on each other. So you need someone or a team of people, not necessarily just one person, depending on the size of the organization and size of the program, is to have people up at the top that understand what's going on and making sure that it's their role to inform each of the leads that they need to be aware of other things. So, because they're focused in, they're blinkered, they're focused in on delivering their section. So it's your or my it was my responsibility to say, you need to be aware of this over here, because that's going to affect how you deliver your service. SCOM versus VMM, or sorry, ConfigMan versus VMM. They both deliver bare metal builds using WDS, which is fine when you're just delivering virtual servers in a data center, because you can cocoon it off using VLANs, etc. But when you start going out to the wider world, and you've got your servers sitting on the same VLANs or the same subnets as the desktops are going to be delivered on, you get conflicts. So you need to decide who's going to be master in delivering the first part of that image down to those environments. Just be aware of that. Desktop encryption. If you've already got desktops encrypted when you're doing the upgrades, you need to know a lot about that, because de-encrypting to rebuild, to put your OS on, that can be a pain. Our third-party encryption that we've currently got on some of the desktops that haven't been migrated over to, it takes anything up to 12 hours to de-encrypt that disk before you can go and actually put on. So during that 12 hours, that desktop, which is normally a laptop, is at risk of having data stolen. So we have a rule that, depending on who they are, whatever, those particular laptops are asked to be left on site, they're locked in a room, and the upgrade happens during the night, and they come back in the next morning, pick up their laptop, and off they go. Networks, absolutely know your networks, know your ports. One of the things that I was constantly beating my leads up on is go in there, know what ports you're going to require, what protocols you're going to require, and everything, because if you've got firewalled environments, I can guarantee you something won't work, and you'll blame the application, or you'll blame the AD environment, or you'll blame the security of the service account that you think, and actually it's just the firewall. And we've wasted days, sometimes weeks, on trying to resolve those problems, and we get some smart person, I was going to say something else, come in and do some network analysis and say, oh, it's just this port here, and you know, it can be really frustrating for you. And the last one we've talked about quite a bit is the storage configuration. Storage configuration is important to get right from the start, and I can say that with quite qualified experience, because about 2 months into this program, we decided to change the storage configuration. So we had to go through a whole process of figuring out how to migrate all our VMs off the current storage configuration onto the new storage configuration without interrupting any service. And that's not easy. So just be aware of that. That's about it.
You've only got a couple of minutes for questions. Any questions for Alistair? So I've got one question for you, Alistair, to wrap it up. What's your experiences working on the TAP program? What are the key things that you think were good for success?
Well, if I was very non-political, I would say you get better service when you're on the tap because they don't want you to fail. But I won't dare say that.
You just did.
No, seriously, it's been very good. You know, we've had a lot of help in putting this stuff through. The reality is Microsoft wants you to be successful when you're on this, so they'll put every effort into making sure they listen to us. We tell them what's wrong, what's not working. They fix it in most places. There's only been, I think, one instance where they said, well, that's not in this release, we won't get that fixed, but here's a workaround to get around it. So it's, you know, from that perspective, it's very much, it's well worth participating in TAPS if you get the opportunity to do that. It is a risk, without a doubt, but you can manage that risk, so you can. Build in plenty of buffer times where you can. We didn't necessarily have that on this project because we started this back in May of last year, bidding for it. We got accepted for the bid in July. We got the first design phase done by September, and we started rolling out in September and got the first production desktops going out in November. And we're due to be finished rolling out 27,000 desktops by the end of November this year across 1,400 sites. So you need to know your environments, you need to know, and you need to be able to handle change, you need to be able to handle problems. Your teams need to be very adaptable and very dedicated when you're working in a project like this, because there's a lot of moving components on this one if you're doing programs like this. Normally, I wouldn't recommend that you take what we've done and do it all in one program.
Well, thanks everyone for listening, and hopefully that was useful.